Ruth chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself therefore and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down, and then he will tell you what you shall do." She said to her, "All that you say, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and covered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" She answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you that you teach us not just by precept, not just by law, not just through reflection in the Psalms or quick, pithy statements of wisdom in Proverbs, but that you unfold for us the working out of your gracious purposes in the lives of people who look like you and have a heart that beats after the things that your heart strives for. Lord, I pray that you would transform us, that you would shepherd us, that you would show us your kindness and your grace to us as we read your word this morning. I pray this in Christ's most perfect name. Amen. Now, before we go anywhere, let me quote to you one of my really erudite commentaries. In this passage, there is no hanky-panky, and they are as pure as the driven snow. Okay, that was very erudite. And it's true. Okay, we'll work through it. We'll see that this is risky business. There's some ambiguity and some uncertainty to work our way through. But I think, just so you know where I'm coming from, which is I think where the text is coming from, there's no need to worry. You may not try it at home, but there's no need to worry. Now, last week, and again, I don't know if Brittany's here, but I promised I wouldn't do lots of recap. Last week, we ended in a really happy place, right? You go out in the morning to hope you're going to have lunch by the middle of the day or by night, and you end up with a job. That's a good place to be. The immediate concerns for Naomi and Ruth's future have been largely dealt with. But now we fast forwarded towards the end of the harvest, and this year's over. And there's still some unresolved tension to the future of these two women's lives. And so Naomi, who has come to life again in the text by the kindness of God reaching out to her through Boaz, Naomi says to Ruth this very tender thing. She says, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you?" Right. And this has been something, if you remember, that Naomi has had in the back of her mind all the way through. Right? This is the prayer that she prays for Naomi and Orpah when she's leaving Moab. "May you find rest. May you find security in the home, each of you, of her husband." Of course, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. But this concern, which is a good concern, right? This kind concern on Naomi's part is coming back into view, because the elation, the joy, and the security of working in Boaz's field for the year is winding down. Now, they're set, I think, for the rest of the year. This is why I said last week, the way this works, you get enough food, you store it up, then you eat all the way through the year. But the fact of the matter is, will he let her come back next year? What's going to happen? How are things going to change? There is still a great lack of security in their lives. And Naomi, I think, very tenderly here says, "You know what? You, my daughter, who have cared so well for me, it's time that I start to carry some of this load," right? You've been carrying all the load, literally, carrying these huge sacks of grain home. It's time for me to start carrying some of the load. Should I not seek this security for you? And this is a lovely phrase, that it would be well with you. The Hebrews literally, it says it would be good. It would be good with you. So what we'll see as we work our way through this morning and probably next week as well, I'm not quite sure how far I can get this morning. We'll try to cover it well, but not sure. What we'll see this morning is Naomi's predicament, if you will, her problem. How is problems easier, isn't it? The problem, Naomi's problem, and then Naomi's plan, and then Ruth's proposal, and maybe we'll get towards some of the resolution of it, but probably not that much. So we'll work our way first to the problem, the plan, and the proposal, and see where we end up. So it's a little hard to say, here's the theme of this, since I'm not quite sure where I'm going to end, but maybe we'll get to this more next week. I don't know, but you can have it in the back of your mind that through this text, we see that God's people are captivated. They're rejoicing. They're driven by, their hearts are linked to God's plan with his people. The people of God love, they're captivated by the outworkings of God's plan with his people. So we have the problem. We need to find security. That's reasonable enough, right? That's the last point in this text that I think we can all go, got it, clear, understand it, sweet. Now the plan gets interesting, right? I told Jen on Monday after I finished doing my first big study, like, I know they did this, but I can't help thinking, has got to have been a better way to do this, right? There's got to have been a better plan towards seeking security than the one they chose. But I thought, well, you know what? This is what we do, right? When we meet difficulties in the text, we stay with the text, right? You keep reading, you keep thinking, you stay with the text, you come back to it again. This book I read this week said that the Hebrew Bible and the writers of the Hebrew Bible were really masterful in this. You could overread the text, you can underread the text, but you can't counterread the text. You can't, the dumbest reader is gonna get helped along. Like, you're gonna get the text. So I need all the help I can get, and all the help I need is here in the text with the help of God's Spirit. So I thought all week, like, there has gotta be a better plan than this one. But you know what? I don't know that there is. So as we talk about this, I want to alert you to her plan. We'll see her solution here that she's got in mind. She says, I want to seek security for you. Now, is not Boaz our kinsman? I need security. Lo and behold, we've had this already, this relationship with Boaz. He's our kinsman. You've been with him. So I've got a plan that involves Boaz. And that draws our attention to Naomi's thinking, particularly in line of his relationship to the family of Abimelech. So we have to stop for a moment. And I hate when people do this one thing, and I think you do too. I hate when people tell me I have this really difficult text, and then I'm going to tell you all these obscure things about this culture that you don't know. And at the end of it, after I've gone through a million gyrations, you're going to be like, okay, I could see how that could be that way, maybe. I'm sorry, I'm not going to pick on John MacArthur, but every once in a while he does that with parables. And I'm just like, that may be true, but I've had to jump through so many interpretive hoops that I wouldn't just naturally see in the text. I'm not really sure. Okay, so what I'm not doing this morning is, now I'm not going to say, my code word is not, we're going to go look back at the history of the text to teach you all these obscure things. I'm just going to bring you back into what we see from Scripture and then show you why I think this plan makes at least some sense in those lines. Okay? Turn with me very quickly to Leviticus, and I just lost half of you, Leviticus 25. It's two short verses. And while you're turning there, those of you who are speedy can answer a question for me. She brings attention to this relationship, and particularly we'll see as we work through the text this idea of a redeemer. So tell me, just from your reading and from your Sunday school and flannel graph and anything else you might happen to know, tell me what this word redeemer brings into your mind. What do you know about this idea?
This one chapter is talking about, the year of Jubilee, that if you were to sell yourself into slavery or something like that, you would at some point, you wouldn't be stuck there forever. You would be redeemed, you would be brought back into freedom and security, and your land would be returned to you all at some point.
Okay. I wish you hadn't said that. No, I'm joking. No, we're getting there. We're getting there. No. Okay. What else? What else?
The goal is to keep the land within the possession of Israel and all the bloodlines moving forward so that the people aren't cut off or intermixed with the nations around.
Okay, that was about one sentence of what I was going to take 5 minutes to say, so thank you. Other things.
I guess what always came to mind when I think of redeeming is to purchase something that you already had a right to anyway, that you could pay for.
I think a really key thing there is this idea of purchase or cost, right? That's present in there. Other thoughts? Who does redeeming?
You mean from the Old Testament?
God. Okay, somebody said that. Thank you. Yeah, right? God is the picture of redeeming, right? But who else does redeeming? Who is it?
Jesus
does the redeeming. Somebody who has a relationship to the family, right? Somebody that has an interest, a care that's there. Yeah. I think sometimes, at least in my thinking, I think either really strictly in terms of like the year of the Jubilee, or I think really strictly in terms of kind of maybe the big picture of salvation in terms of redemption. It's actually kind of like being a superhero. It's this really full, this really beautiful, I think, this great office, this great job that you get to have if you love your family, you love God's work and the nation. And I think that the key text that just centers this idea for me is Leviticus 25, verse 23 and verse 24, where in the middle of describing the work, the maybe the details, the legal code of what a redeemer is to do, there's this theological statement: the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. This is, I think, it just gets at all down to the core. That, as Sam said, the people are God's and the land is God's. And God's working out of his promises in the land are dependent on these things, right? This is God's land. This is his gift, his inheritance. We'll see in a bit when we get to chapter 4. Remember Mr. No Name that doesn't do the redeeming? He says, I can't jeopardize my inheritance, right? Well, when we think about that, we think about, I can't jeopardize what I'm going to give to my kids, which is true. But he's also thinking what I have, this safeguard that I have from my parents all the way through. In his mind, the inheritance is his land. It's not just something that he's going to pass on. It's he has to safeguard what's been given to him. This land that he has, which is the outworking of God's purposes with his people, he has to safeguard it. And there's this provision here that there will be a rescuer, somebody to come deal with. In fact, the Redeemer can do all sorts of things, right? If somebody dies, if somebody's murdered in the family, the Redeemer goes and tracks them down, right? This is the Goel of blood, the Redeemer of blood. He goes and tracks them down because God's purposes with this family can't be interrupted, and there's a price for that, right? He has such a concern for the family and the progression of God's work that he's the avenger of those things. You'll see that God is talked about as a lawyer, as a Redeemer. In Proverbs, it talks about how God will plead the case of an orphan, right? He's the one who would argue that case against somebody who would come against us. He uses all of his resources, his vengeance, his faculties, his power in society, his wealth, whatever it is to go and protect the way that God's working out these families and this place. I have a whole list here that I don't really need to read that kind of summarizes all the different things that a redeemer does in Israel. There's five big ones. He buys back hereditary property that's passed into the hands of people outside the clan. He buys back the freedom of people within the clan who'd sold themselves. He tracks down and executes murderers. He receives restitution money on behalf of a deceased victim of a crime. He ensures that justice was served in a lawsuit. And so all of this is to protect, to maintain these family relationships on the land that they've given, even if the person has died, right? And of course, this is just a picture of what God has done for his people, Exodus is the picture of redemption in the Old Testament. The people are oppressed. They're in a land. They're enslaved. And God purchases them. He makes this statement that he purchases them, but not with money, but with his power. He goes out and he uses his power and his resources to draw his people back. And from then on, they belong to him. And in fact, the Levites have to be, we talked about this in a different book, in a different study, the Levites have to be redeemed from the people because they belong to him specially, right? The firstborn belong to him specially. There's this idea of God's ownership and God's plan all through the Old Testament that's really precious to his people, except we're in the time of the judges and very little of God's work in the people and in the land is precious. There's a background to it. It's just not a lot of practice, I think, where we're at. So the plan. We have a predicament. We need security. We have a plan. Wash self. Oh, he's going to be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Why do you winnow barley at the threshing floor at night? You know? The wind blows at night. It blows just the right amount at night that you get a steady wind so that when you toss the wheat up in the air, the chaff blows away, and you don't blow away, and the grain doesn't blow away, right? So you get these consistent, steady winds at night, and it's probably also a little cooler to work in the night. So everybody goes out to the threshing floor. Boaz might have been prominent enough, wealthy enough that he had his own. It's more likely there's kind of the threshing area that you do up on this rocky outcrop somewhere near town, as Israel has got lots of rocky outcrops, so there's plenty to go around. You go up, you beat it out, and then what do? You go home and you sleep soundly. No, because you just turned the work into pure gold that you can eat, and you don't just leave it there. It's late at night, so you're not going to take it home, you're not going to store it that night, but you're not going to leave it unguarded. And all through the scripture, we'll see examples of like the Midianites come and they raid the threshing floors, right? It's like bank robbery. The food is there. So what do? You spend the night out in the field with your stuff. It's like literally sleeping on your hoard of gold, except you don't turn into a dragon. Okay, you have to guard the stuff. And so generally what would happen is you do it, then you have a big party because you did it. I mean, this is great. We're done. That's kind of the end of the major part of the working year. And then you sleep lightly by it. By the way, this is really good evidence for why he's probably not just completely drunk. Maybe somebody he was working for was, but I guarantee you he's like, somebody's got to keep an eye on this. We'll talk about it. I don't think he's drunk at all, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But you got to keep an eye on your stuff. So this is like the one night in the year that a rich dude is probably not going to sleep in his own bed. And that's important to this crazy plan. So he's going to winnow barley at the threshing floor. So here's the plan. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes. Now, he didn't bathe very much back then. So it's basically like, hey, freshen up for a party. Okay? I don't think you can overread this. It's just, don't look like you just finished your shift. Okay, Joe's used to come over and from Chick-fil-A, and I know a lot of you guys work at Chick-fil-A, and I love Chick-fil-A, but I do not like the smell of somebody who just worked at Chick-fil-A, right? It's just like, wow, the peanut oil is not longer an essential oil, right? It's like, this is gone too far. So she's saying, okay, this is not how the Bible ever describes somebody who's trying to be flirty, who's trying to be suggestive. It's just, don't look like that, okay? Anoint yourself. People are like, oh, no, look, it's deodorant, okay? In the ancient world, you put oil on because you don't smell good all the time. And actually, they also thought it was really healthy for you. So if you are into essential oils, you can run with that. I'm not going to touch that other than to say, look good. She said, look good, dress up, clean yourself up. And maybe, although I really don't see this in the text, it's really hard to say, maybe she's saying stop dressing like a widow. I really don't see that there because there's no indication she's been doing that. There's a ton of commentators think like, well, Boaz hasn't said anything to her yet because she's dressing like a widow, so he doesn't want to go in that. But does it say don't dress like a widow? No, it just says dress up. In fact, it's probably put your clothes that you were wearing back on after you dress because they usually only had two or three pairs of clothes, but maybe she has a nicer one. Dress up and go to the party. So far, this is not a bad plan. Okay, I understand this plan so far. But don't let him know you're there. At that point, I'm starting to like, oh, this is not where I expected this to go. Until he's finished eating and drinking, may it happen when he lies down that you take notice of the place where he'll be lying. Okay. Then enter, uncover the place of his feet, pull the blanket back from his feet, lie down. And now this is the central part of Naomi's plan here. He will tell you what to do. Right. Okay, now that's a strange plan. Why do you need this plan? Well, a couple thoughts. In this time, you cannot go propose to somebody as a matter of daily business, right? It's inadvisable. Think about this. Where is Boaz likely to be most of the time? In his place of business. Generally, I think in the city, and particularly often, as you see, he's prominent in the governance of the city and the way things go, so they would hang out in the gates in the city, right, with all the leading men of the city. So what do you not do? Walk up to somebody while he's in his office? Like, if I came and visited any of you at work, how happy would you be with me? Probably not like, hey, it's great to see you. Could you not, like, my boss is watching and he's kind of, you know, you don't embarrass me. If you came, I had a friend who tried this almost, who proposed to his girlfriend in her company's parking lot, which I don't recommend. But, you know, it's just you're grimacing already, right? Well, as a woman, you're particularly not going to come propose to the guy, which you don't do anyway, in his company parking lot, right? You're putting him in this terribly embarrassing position. I just think that there's no recourse to, like, hey, I want an appointment with you. That's not something that happens, right? In a place that it's not, there's not all this observation and the potential for massive embarrassment to him. You want him to listen, not to be like. So I think that's the first thing. Now, again, when do you know? And this is the key part of the plan. There's an urgency to the plan because the harvest is over, so her daily interaction is going away. But again, you can't just say this in the field if he shows up. Everybody's watching. So when do you know that he's going to be somewhere that he's not at home? You can't go to his house. I really doubt you could go knock on the door. Is Boaz home? You know, I'm not seeing the access there. So I think to summarize all of what I'm saying is that there's a problem of access, that Naomi has one real clear night that she knows the problem of access is solved. I know he's going to be sleeping on his grain. Okay. And I think this is part of the reason that we're doing the alarm clock routine, which is he's going to go to sleep. How are you going to talk to him privately? Oh, I know. Let's pull the covers back. And he'll wake up when he gets cold, which, lo and behold, he wakes up when he gets cold. Again, it's a plan. Up to this point, I'm still like, it's kind of an odd plan. Okay, would you try this at home? I don't think so. Now, if you want to wake your parents up in the middle of the night or brother and sister or something, I guarantee you if you sneak in and pull their covers back when they get cold, they're going to wake up. So that's a pretty good trick if you need to file that away somewhere. But the key of it is, when you have this encounter, when he wakes up, there's this confidence that the core of the plan is Naomi's confidence. He will tell you what to do. When all this crazy stuff has happened, because he's our relative, because he's been taking care of you, Naomi's confidence is he's going to tell you what to do. Now, that's where I started this week with going, okay, I understand the plan. I get the basics of the plan, and I get the confidence that she has in the plan. I still don't see why this plan. I get access. I get that there's an opportunity here. But why this plan? It's such an unusual plan. Well, I think it's going to unfold for us as we go here. So what does Ruth say? She's a very wonderful daughter-in-law. She says, everything that you say, I will do. And then what does the text do? It repeats everything she said to show you that she did it, right? So Boaz eats and he drinks and his heart was happy. Verse 7. Of course his heart is happy, right? People read this, oh, he got drunk. No, he didn't get drunk. Have you ever had a really, really good day at work? And you get home, and you sit down on your couch. That's what this description is here. It was good in his heart. One of my favorite verses for work is the sleep of the working man is sweet, right? You work hard, you please the Lord, you sit down and the day is done, and you're just satisfied, right? And I think that satisfaction is going to be important here as we go. But he's done his work, and life is good. He's very content. And shouldn't he be? This excellent man who has probably brought in another really great harvest, who cares well for people, and everything that he's done is cause for. And don't miss this. When you work well as a righteous man, this is a good thing. This is a good thing to sit down and go, God has been so gracious this year. I am content. This is a good place to be. His life's about to get turned upside down, but he doesn't know that yet. She follows the plan. She sneaks up. She uncovers the place of his feet, and she lay down. You notice it doesn't say she slept. Could you imagine sleeping? I could not imagine sleeping. He gets cold. It's funny, actually, this phrase here, the man shivered, has the NASB say it, says he was startled. That's because the word here is one that's used for, like, abject terror, like freezing to death. But actually what it is, I think it's describing here is that he's like, I'm freezing. Literally, I'm freezing. Where's the cover? Where's the cover? What is that? Okay. Oh, my gosh, it's a woman. Now, all of that leading up to, surprise, who are you? And she says the most amazing thing. Now, notice this. Notice, what did Naomi tell her to do? Nothing. Whispered because I'm scary. Nothing. She said, when he wakes up, trust his character, trust that he will tell you what to do, right? He wakes up, says, who are you? She has a speech. Okay? Now, it's very hard to say, did she and Naomi have this idea in mind? I think some of it, yes. Or is this Ruth acting as Ruth again? And I think that's more the case, okay? Because Naomi's concern is, I'm going to take care of you. But Ruth's concern is bigger than, I would like security. Ruth's concern is way bigger. They're complementary concerns. And the plan, as we'll see, helps highlight both of them. But Ruth's plan is way bigger than Naomi's plan, I think. He says, who are you? And she answers, I am Ruth, your maidservant, and you must, this is my borrowed translation, I think it's much clearer, you must spread your garment over your maidservant. For, you, here's what you must do, and here's why. You must spread your garment over your maidservant, for you are a redeemer. He says, who are you? And in effect, she says, well, who are you? Right? Are you going to act like who I think you are? Now, this is the beauty of this plan, and this is what helped me understand, okay, why this plan? This plan puts into almost picture form the need that these women have here, right? This plan is one that's designed to maximize the effectiveness of what Ruth is going to say, not by manipulation, but by very poignantly, and I'm going to use this word carefully, very intimately portraying the need that these women have and that they're asking Boaz and Boaz only to fill. If you'll remember, and I've said before, that Moabites don't have good track records with nighttime visits. And particularly, the entire, I won't go regurgitate the whole horrible history of Moab, but behind Lot's daughter's incest was this concern. We have to take care of ourselves, right? We have to make sure that we don't miss out on the way life goes on. So I think there's some tension here, both for you and I as readers, but particularly for anybody in Bethlehem at the time, like, how is this woman going to resolve her problems? We know how her family, in history past, we know how her family goes about seeking, how her whole race goes about seeking solutions to their problems of, you know, how are we going to have security? How are we going to move forward? How is she going to do it? So I do think there's some tension here intentionally in the text where you're like, what is she doing? Not because the narrator doesn't know, but because there's some track record here. And in fact, it highlights the extraordinary nature of what she does do. But she is painting a picture, if you will, of where she and Naomi are at in life. I think it's the only time you could do it. But this is where she's at in life. She's incredibly vulnerable, right? And even in this request, is she not incredibly vulnerable in the middle of the night on the threshing floor, you know what men do in the middle of the night on the threshing floor? You have to read the prophets and you'll find out. Every prophet will tell you what happens in the middle of the night on a threshing floor, and it's not good. Okay? She's incredibly vulnerable, but is this not true of a foreign widow in the land? Did not we see all the way through the last chapter, there's this constantly recurring theme of, at least in his field you'll be safe, because who knows who might fall upon you in another field? That's not exaggeration. She's incredibly vulnerable. She says this beautiful thing, would you spread your cover over me? It's a very intimate picture of what she and Naomi need. She doesn't need just his grain. She needs the security and literally the covering, the protection of marriage. So this is what Naomi has in mind, particularly. So you need a husband. You need to be protected. Now, it's so hard for us in our day and age because even some of you who are really strongly complementarian in your view about women, and particularly I think my young ladies are like, I don't need nothing, right? Right? And I get that, okay? But bear with me here. This is Ruth talking. Ruth is a pretty beastly woman. She's driving this train, we'll see. She has a lot of competence in herself. What she's saying very poignantly is, I need the long-term provision that comes with the way God designed marriage. First, we'll see there's even more to it than that. This is what I need. And isn't this an intimate way when his heart is content in the work that God's done? She repeats his prayer back to him. Right? His prayers, may you find reward from Yahweh, under whose wings you have come to find refuge. And she says, be the answer to your prayer. Right? Give me that refuge. Give me the long-term security and care and tenderness that I need to, as I said last week, to run in the lane that God has given me. It's not that she can't provide. She can. But bigger than that, it's a picture of what Naomi needs. And this is where Ruth transforms, I think, what she says. I need this because Naomi needs, and I'm going to use this word carefully too, Naomi needs full salvation. She needs full restoration, right? Naomi says, I just want you to be taken care of. Now, of course, if she gets married, son-in-law is going to take care of Naomi, right? That's not really unlikely. But Ruth says, you're a redeemer. I need Naomi's family. I need the family of Elimelech to be restored to its proper place in the work of God in the land. That's amazing. And this is a visual picture of it. I am out here on my own in a very vulnerable place, and I'm asking you, would your heart, as it is content in the work of God, would your heart be moved with the very compassion and kindness of God to spread your own covering over me? Right? It's an appeal. It is an appeal to his character, and it is an appeal to his mirroring the kindness of God. And it's designed to have this very powerful effect, and it's not inappropriate to say it's a very risky way of stating, this is the urgency of what I think you need to do for God's plan in the life of the nation. This needs to happen now, and this is the picture of it. Boaz gets it. Boaz is not surprised. He's shocked that she's there, but the comprehension comes right away. What does he say? May you be blessed by Yahweh, my daughter. Okay? First point, just to solidify the no hanky-panky part of this, that is not the response you have when you wake up and you think that it's a prostitute that's come to visit you in the night. And then you're surprised by what they say. Okay, so just so we nail that down, his character is not in doubt here. There's nobody going, oh, we see what she's up to. He recovers from his surprise with this instant theological clarity. May you be blessed of Yahweh. She's just come to a wealthy landowner in his own field and told him, you need to marry me, the outcast widow, and you need to give up your own inheritance, the security of your own inheritance, to protect my dead husband's family. That's not a business proposition that most people respond well to in the middle of the night or in the daytime in the gate, like we'll see Mr. No Name does. But his response to this shockingly daring thing to say is, may you be blessed of Yahweh. Why? Because he gets it. You have demonstrated your last kindness to surpass the first. What's the first kindness? It's the first great kindness Ruth does. She goes with Naomi. Okay? Now, until this week, I didn't think there was anything to eclipse the beauty and the example of God's chesed, his loving kindness, than where you go, I will go. Right? But Boaz says, this beats all that. Okay? Your this kindness is even more amazing and shocking than your other kindness. Now, everybody's been terrified about this verse all week, and ever since I started Ruth, actually, because you didn't go after young men, either poor or rich. Okay? I told you someday we would have to talk about the young man, old man thing. Okay? I think I told you a couple weeks ago, I am convinced that Boaz is a generation older than Ruth and a generation younger than Naomi, so Ruth's probably 50, 55, I would say probably 55 to 60, somewhere in there. Ruth, if we assume that her first marriage happens at 14, which I think is almost certain, there's very little variance in the ancient world. People usually get married right about 14 when they're a woman. So let's give 10 years, plus or minus a little bit. She's probably mid-20s. Okay, so I think we got this range nailed down for him, which all I'm going to say about that is not that old, right? It's older, but if you want even further proof that he's not that old, the dude just threshed his own wheat out in his field. I mean, it's not like, oh, okay, I pulled my back. Hey, this was a good day at work. Okay, what is the point of this young man thing? He says, you didn't pursue a young man, either poor or rich, which helps give us some more clarity. Well, why would you pursue a young man? Now, in our age, you pursue a young man because he's so cute. Okay, maybe some of that is there. But what is a young man not going to do on you, to you? Die. Exactly. Okay? Why would you marry the old dude when you're a widow and you've just gone through this? You need to marry the young guy. What else is the young guy going to do? He's going to make sure you have a lot of kids. He's going to take care of you for a long time, right? So I do think there's a little, he's cute, okay? So all of that together, he's saying, you didn't do that. Or what do these other two options tell us? Poor or rich? Okay, you didn't marry for love. I don't care if he's poor. You didn't marry for advantage. He's so rich, right? He's saying there's one thing that guided you in this. It's not that I'm so old, okay? There's one thing. You didn't pursue preference. You didn't pursue anything else other than your being just absolutely compelled to work out the purposes of God in the life of his nation, right? This is this mark of chesed, that the first thing that you are doing, even when your mother-in-law is just pursuing your own security, you're pursuing the life of Elimelech's house in the nation. It's amazing, guys. This is this amazing picture of chesed. She's captivated with God's work in the nation, which is exactly what the heart of a redeemer is supposed to be. He's supposed to be captivated with the work of God in the nation, because God has promised this place not just for his people to camp out and enjoy the grapes, right? It's this place where we have this promise that God's working out of his commitment to Abraham that all the nations of the earth would be blessed is going to happen. This is the forward landing zone for God's work in salvation, right? This land matters for that. And the people matter, particularly the people in the line of Judah matter, because we have this promise, right, that there will be a prince in Judah, that there is this coming king in Judah, and that matters. And by the way, if you think I'm overreading that, what do the ladies say to her when she gets married? May you be like Perez, right? May you be like the one who we know is going to bring the king in the life of the nation. Okay? I don't think that's overreading it. Now, here's what's remarkable about that. This is a foreigner. And the thing that motivates her is the thought not only that God is great and he's working out this plan, but my obedience and my commitment to what he has promised and said in his word matters to it. Right? Isn't it so easy for us to hold all of this theology that we know and not think like anything we do in our lives actually works out any of that? And here, in the land of Israel, where everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes, and they don't care about these amazing promises, you have this one Moabite woman who says, the line of Elimelech can't be snuffed out because God's working something out through his people in this place. That's amazing. She would be so bought into what God is doing that she's a lesson to the whole nation on what it looks like to have a heart for God's people and God's land. And Boaz gets it immediately. You proposed to me because you are committed to what God's doing. May you be blessed of Yahweh. This mark of his head is greater than anything you have done up to this point, because you have, even in this most central, this most intimate human relationship, you've prioritized God's work, God's character. Now, we'll talk about more of it next week, because we can't finish there for the whole thing, because there's going to be a big complication coming around the corner. And you actually don't know if he said yes yet. You can read ahead. It's okay. And let me just make a couple comments on the nature of relationships and biblical manhood and womanhood, because I know you're all thinking, like, what are you telling me to do from this, okay? First thing I'm telling you to do is don't do this, okay? A, you don't live in Israel. You don't need a redeemer. You have one. He's better, okay? But what you do need to do and think about, both men and women, this beautiful picture that she paints, every inch of this plan is carefully intended to bring to Boaz, not just in words, but by every means of persuasion available, this intimate, important life of the nation need, right? Guys, communicate like that, right? When you're talking to people about the gospel, when I'm talking to people about the gospel, I was talking to one of my coworkers yesterday, and then I read this, and I was just like, the urgency that I lack that she shows, right? Put yourself in the right vulnerable situations to appeal to people, to turn from sin, to trust God, to go run after the people in this college group. We were talking earlier about our care team and how that's a vital way, I use that word intentionally, a vital way that we care for you is this ministry. All of you as young adults are caring for one another, and we are, as James was saying last week, we are grabbing those people as they're in college and they're moving away from the faith and they're really wrestling with whether they love Christ or not. Grab them and pull them back in. As he said, the devil is playing for keeps, right? This is the urgency that you ought to bring to it. This is the level of commitment you ought to have to it. Be so mindful with that your obedience does matter, that God is building his church through you and I. A Moabite woman thinks the land matters and Naomi's line matters, and I would love to see her restored all the way, even better than it was before. This is what Christ is doing in his church. He's building a people. He's building a bride for his son. He's building a witness to the nations. And every act of obedience that you have, every inch of your commitment to what God is doing, is a mark of God's chesed in you. Now, finally, briefly on the nature of relationships. First point to notice here is that what does Boaz do as the man? The Gabor Chayil. He listens to her, okay? Okay, that ought to tell you right there how I feel about complementarity. Being a leader in your home or being a leader as a man means that you are quick to listen to godly advice, particularly when it comes from your spouse, right? I'm saying that to my wife because she knows I believe it, but every time I can say it is better, okay? Chris would call that leading strongly in your spouse's direction, right? You know, I don't know what's going on. Hey, this seems good. Yeah, we're going to do that. Follow me as I listen to you, okay? That's great. Second, guys, what a beautiful picture of what it means to be a godly man. Your character is so in tune with God's character, and your purposes are so in tune with God's purposes that when something pops up in your life and you see this clear example of you need to invest everything you have in running faithfully after God, that's already what you're doing. So you're like, okay. And that the women who know you know that you are absolutely safe, righteous, and honorable because that's just the way you are. You are already taking care of people. When they're taking care of you and they take you out to lunch, you're not like, well, I wonder if this is the only time he's ever been generous in his life. They just know what you're like because that's how you live in the life of the church. And what a beautiful picture of what marriage is. You ought to be. Boaz is properly drawn to this need to provide this intimate, careful, personal care for her, right? Marriage, we talk so much in our church about being careful about how you enter into marriages. Please do be. We talk so much about being wise and cautious and thinking carefully and not settling and all this stuff. But guys, the view of biblical marriage is that it is a wonderful, good thing where you pour out your life and you absolutely give everything you have, even if you're covering a little tiny, you have a little tiny job, a little tiny career, you can have just this much, right? I want to bring you into carefully caring for you so that you can run in the lane that God has given you to run in. That's a beautiful thing. And ladies, I'm not telling you go find a redeemer, he's the only person you can marry. That there isn't one. I'm not even saying you can't like him, he can't be cute, he can't anything else, okay? All the way through this text, there's this tension that the narrator builds of like, wouldn't it be great if they were together? And I think they have a really joyful, wonderful marriage, particularly because two people who love the Lord like that probably can't not, right? But I don't think there's anything wrong with personal preference in marriage. But would you give up building in your head this idea of what the perfect guy is going to be? Because I guarantee you that's not who you're going to meet. Look for these things. Love the character of the man you meet, but be willing to be like, oh, his hair is red and I wanted it black, right? Okay? He doesn't have hair. Okay? Looks like my dad. You know what? All men look like your dad eventually, okay? Because the workplace says they have to. Okay? It's just may your priorities be, I want to run after a man who's built his heart around the purposes and the people of God. That doesn't mean you settle for somebody you don't like. It means you don't settle for somebody who's not like Boaz. It's a beautiful picture of what marriage is. And they just lay it all on the line of this is what we need. And Boaz's heart is, may God be praised that we can pursue his purposes together. What a beautiful picture of marriage. All right, I went over my time. Sorry, 2 minutes extra. Next week we'll talk about the surprising turn and the patience that they have to show. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you again this week that in this account we see how much you personally care for us. Christ is our Redeemer. This is the personal care that you've given us. You have redeemed us in Christ. You have spread your wings over us. You love and care for us. We are vulnerable. We are enslaved in our sin apart from you. We are, in fact, dead apart from you. And yet this is the measure and the truth of your grace, that you love us deeply and you will work out your purposes in the lives of those who trust you. May our hearts be full of faith and trust and joy in the provision and care of Christ this week. Pray this in his name. Amen.